Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to an extempore interaction with Professor G. Venkatraman, wherein through a conversation with radio-sized Bishu, he shares his thoughts about the golden age and how and when can we see this happening around us. This was recorded at the Sri Satya Sai General Hospital at Puttaparthi on May 16, 2015.
Sairam sir, and thank you very much for making yourself available for this interaction session. We had a series of interaction sessions on the Dharma series, and now for a change, last Thursday we had something where we discussed about the cosmic connection between the macrocosm and microcosm, and today you are open to a new topic. So it's nice that we have for a change, discussing something other than dharma for a little while.
Well, thank you for coming here, and for the benefit of listeners, I must say, I am taking a brief holiday from dharma series in order to be here in this hospital where I don't have to do anything. And it's getting pretty boring. It's nice of you to have come and given me a break by remembering that I am there and I can also participate in radio programs.
you are very much part of radio and very much contributing wherever and whichever part of the world you are in or however you are in.
I don't know about being part of the radio, but I can tell you over here I have been listening a lot to the radio, and that is the only way I can pass time, apart from trying to do some work and reading, which is out there. Okay, so what is it you want to discuss?
Now that you are listening a lot on the radio to what's happening all around the world, may I ask you something which a lot of people have asked me, a lot of people have asked my colleagues in Radio Sai. They say that Swami has promised that the golden age will come. Swami has said that when the golden age dawns, there would be peace, there would be happiness, and the world will be a completely different place. So we have found a lot of people who are waiting for it, a lot of people who are anticipating that and just hoping that one day that will just happen. And there is another set of people who say that it is already here. So what do you mean golden age is going to come? Golden age is already here. So you have different people with different perspectives of golden age. There are people who say that, hello, it's we who have to bring that golden age. And there are some people who say that the avatar had come for the golden age. There's nothing that we need to do for that, and so on. So what is your perspective on golden age?
Gosh, I have 10 hours to answer your question. But let me put it like this. You said Swami promised. I would put it as Swami declared that there will be a golden age, and is sure to come. Now, the Bible says the manna dropped from heaven. Golden age is not going to drop from heaven. That is for sure. If you read or listen to Swami's discourses carefully, which you can do on the discourse channel of Radio Sai, and sorry for making that plug, but I think I am entitled to it, you will find there is a lot of fine print. Let me take the statement that you made. Golden age is already here. That is here for those who have become golden. We have to understand what is the meaning of having become gold. As somebody tells them, is a body full of gold? Can we cut off a finger and sell it in the market? No. If you recall, sometimes Swami would say, Bangaru.
Yes.
When he's in a very good mood, when you have done something nice to please him, he'll say, Bangaru, manchi pani chesavu, you have done a good job, something like that. Am I encouraging? That means you are on the path to becoming good, and thereafter better and better and better. You must be on the road to self-improvement. And, okay, that is all nice. What about the golden age as such? golden age, to take off from the last sentence, will come when more and more people focus on being better. Then what happens is, all this joins together and makes a small, what you call, bubble. There's more people, or water drop, I'll say. As more water gathers, the drop becomes bigger. And at a certain stage, it stops being a drop, starts flowing, picking up water from elsewhere. So golden age will dawn when we get out of our chair and stop talking about golden age coming or waiting for it like a cinema to start and doing something with ourselves. And the best way of saying what we should do is to say, what should I do so that Swami calls me Bangaro? That is the simplest way of saying what I should do. See, Socrates asked, how should I behave? And Aristotle gave the answer. If you ask me, I will say, you behave in such a manner, Swami will call you Bangaro. That's all. And he didn't give that title freely. Every act, for that act, he will make you Bangaro. So, I want Swami to say Bangaro in another 5 minutes. So, you get the hang of what to do. As people say in the West, it won't happen as like manna fell from heaven. In the Bible, that's a reference to manna. Manna is divine nectar or something. It won't happen. It has to come through hard work, sadhana, to put it differently. I don't know whether I have sort of communicated the gist, but at least you must be getting a vague idea of what golden age means and what that we have the responsibility to launch the golden age individually and collectively.
Yes, there is.
You get the point?
I get the point.
At least the hang of, broad hang of it.
Yes. But if you can give some examples and if you can elaborate, what is it that we exactly need to do? Because something which, when we look at it, we feel that, okay, yes, in this situation, this is what we should have done, or this is what we need to do. Then we know that we are on that path to being called by Swami as golden. What are those sort of yardsticks for us to measure and see that our acts, that whatever we are doing, are on the path towards the golden age, bringing that golden age?
See, we can't treat this like a project and draw up a list, to-do list, and go on checking boxes. That would be too mechanistic a way of doing it. I'll tell you what the broad object of it is, and then try to say something about what individuals must do so that the broad objectives are met by them in their particular circumstance in the world. That is extremely important. The broad object is to literally get rid of desires. See, what? How can I get rid of desires? That's very tough. Yes, it is tough. And do you know why it is tough? Because we are attached to these things. You can't say, do I have to stop eating? No, nothing like that. Desire is something that wants me to do something to gratify my senses. Eating food is not gratifying the senses. You eat food because your body needs nourishment. It's in fact a duty. In fact, you must eat food in the sense of executing a duty ordained by God. That's the way you should do it. Desire is something that distracts my attention away from God. So as long as I'm trying to increase my God-centric nature, my desires will come down. How does bringing desires help? Desires distract my attention from God. People in the old days used to get up in the morning, wash and pray, and then begin the work. You have been in Swami's hostel, you begin with Suprabhatam in the morning. Today, I find young people get up and immediately take the phone near this, start looking at it. I don't know what they look at. This has become almost a natural habit. Start the day with love, start the day with God, has been replaced by start the day with your smartphone, spend the day with your smartphone, end the day with your smartphone. This is fulfillment. Something like that has happened. You don't have to take my word for it. You see that happening. All this is a distraction. This is not to say that I should live without a phone like a hermit in a forest. No. But here comes your station in life. Krishna says to Arjuna, Arjuna, you are a kshatriya. That's where destiny has placed you. Live like a kshatriya. But treat your actions as actions that have been commanded by God and do it in that spirit. At the practical level, there are check boxes here. Check boxes are, first thing is, there must be harmony of thought, word and deed. That's not enough. If that is so done, it is okay. But still, it may be evil. An evil man may have evil thoughts, he may say evil things, he may do evil things. There is the world of feeling. Thought is the world of the mind, words is the world of the tongue, and deeds is the world of the body. So action, feel, thought and spoken words may be unison, there may be no contradiction, but it may be evil. Feelings. Feelings must be good, noble, pure. If there is harmony amongst all these four things, namely feelings, thoughts, word and deed, then you are on the right course. And then next thing is checkbox two. Do the action, perform the action, which may be a duty, without any expectations of the outcome. I have to do this job. It does not matter what the outcome is. I am not the one who decides the outcome, it must be clear. Third thing is, if the outcome is good, you are entitled to feel happy. I mean, there is no ban on that. And you should not say, I should get a reward for it. So that is third box. Fourth box, try to see if this action can be made as an offering to God. So if these four boxes are ticked at the practical level, these four boxes apply to everyone, from a king to even a beggar. So how can they apply to a beggar? Beggar can express gratitude to the person who gives alms, and the beggar can say, you are really, very, verily you are God. For God alone cares for everyone, you have cared for me. It is quite possible. So when somebody gives you a glass of water and you are thirsty, it is quite possible to show love, reciprocate and all that. I remember here the story of a man, I think he was called Swami Ramdas. This happened within living memory. I read about him. He left home and wandered everywhere, became a yogi. And one day in the north, he stopped at a small tent and he said, Mother, there is a lady inside. Can you give me some water? And she said, I would love to, but you are a yogi and I am a Muslim. He said, I don't know about that. I only see my mother. Mother, will you give me water? He was deeply touched. So there are little things which can be made truly divine. And just by doing these little things, you are on your way to getting rid of desires. Of course, the question can be asked, why is Krishna so insistent on desires? He says, desire is their eternal foe. The answer is, desire binds you and does not allow you, it builds your sense of mine and thine, and does not allow you to really go towards God. And Swami says, everything is for me, I am nothing. And this body is there to only help and please Swami, because Swami will come in thousand ways and ask for my help. I should not say, no, get out and all that.
Yes, I mean, though we know that one has to get rid of desires, but at a practical level, many people say, and we know how difficult it is to live without desires. So perhaps what is possible is a reduction of desires. I think I would, that's why I feel that Swami said, have a ceiling on desires. Swami did not say, have no desires. Swami said, at least at a practical level, you can have a ceiling on desires. And the other thing that can be done, which I feel is, you can, to the extent possible, try and sublimate your desires. Is that not one way of management, of desire management?
See, you are quite right, putting a ceiling on desires is the first step. I'll give a simple example. In the olden days, you know, we all travel by trains. And I used to travel often from Bombay to Madras, to go to my hometown and all that. It's a long journey and the train stops in many places. So, I used to buy some food packets in the station. And then you sit there, come and sell in the compartments also. You start opening it and eating. Of course, beggars are not supposed to be there on the platform, but they will wander around. And they will come and beg for food. I have seen a lot of fellows curse them. You are embarrassed. So you try to give some food. Three fellows come, the food is gone. So you are torn between eating and giving. And if the station goes, you will have to go hungry because it's a long distance train. It makes very few stops. By the next station, it will be tea time. So these are small incidents, but they raise this issue of, you know, sharing and not wanting all of it for yourself. People react differently, that is their nature, that's how they will behave. Their life will go in a certain way. But it is from this you start. Nobody is saying, you are banned from doing this and that. And that example goes back to Janaka, who ruled, who wore a crown, he sat on a throne. He didn't have any desire for that. That's part of the, what you call, it comes with the territory, as the Americans say. So there is no need to feel that you should not have this, you should not have a car and thing. But don't yearn after it. You don't say, my car must be the best in town. Others must all be jealous of it. You remember the TV ad, neighbors envy owner's pride? That is what you have to avoid. And these are all baby steps. So Swami was always very careful. The intention is good. You want to go north. You won't go to the North Pole on day one. But keep going. Eventually you'll go to the North Pole or the South Pole. So that's
I remember. Yes, I remember some time back reading about this philosophy of Ubuntu, of these African tribes. One anthropologist, he proposed a game, they say, to the children of African tribe. And so he put a basket of fruit near a tree and he told them that the first one to reach that fruit would win all the fruits. And when he told this group of African tribal children to run, they all took each other's hands and ran together. And then sat together and they enjoyed the fruit. And when asked why all of them ran like that, because he said one of you could have just completed the race and you would have had all the fruits for yourself. The answer they gave is Ubuntu. And they said, how can one of us be happy if all the others are sad? I am because we are. That is the philosophy of Ubuntu.
This is a very beautiful and touching story. It reminds me of what Alan Greenspan, he is a first-class American conservative, who died in the old conservative. He was the chairman of the Federal Reserve of the United States more than a decade ago. But he understood that prosperity cannot coexist with extreme poverty. And he said, you cannot have an island of prosperity in an ocean of misery. So, these African children were as educated as Alan Greenspan. And in fact, they practiced this, what they should do in order to remove inequality. Alan Greenspan did not say how you break out, wipe out inequity or inequality. And the American society is laden with inequality. In fact, it has grown under free market capitalism in the last few decades. But it's amazing, and I say it's amazing that these African children behave this way, because in the 19th century the white man went there saying, we have to save them for Christ. It's a white man's burden. We are doing a terrible job, difficult job to make them civilized. They are more civilized in their attitudes than the people who came to civilize them. And that people do not realize.
And in fact, is that not true of our ancient culture that we see, even Indian culture, be it Japanese culture, be it Indian culture? If you go to the roots of all these civilizations, you have all these principles somehow ingrained in us. In India, you have those great saints and sages. I think in Chinese and Japanese culture, you have Confucius, and you have all these great leaders who have tried to somehow ensure that these holistic principles of life are part of our daily living and culture.
I agree with you, and I am a great admirer of ancient tradition, people of the past and all that. But we must also not forget there was a lot of aberration in those times, at least in the middle period. And that's why we had the horrible caste system. That's why we had the sati system and so on. But let us not be too hasty in praising them to the skies. Supposing you pull out from the distant past 1,000 years ago some man who was a sannyasi and put him today in today's world, I am sure that sannyasi would start an ashram, hire PR experts and try to sell spirituality. The environment is such that even a good man is affected by it. It takes a tough guy like Gandhi to really understand what all this means. Now it is dangerous to the soul. So, if people today have become like this, it is the degeneration that has started about 50, 60 years ago. And I can speak about it because 60 years ago, all these things were not available. All the conveniences that you have. And life was simple, harsh, but people were good. They did not have all these distractions of 24-hour TV at 400 channels and what have you. And showing things which are better not seen. And in the process wasting a lot of electrical energy and so on and so forth. They lived a life which had sort of connected to the past. Their drama plays, music, everything was God-oriented. It was not the way it is. Even simple thing like cricket. I saw for the first time a Ranji Trophy match sometime in, 40s. It was in Calcutta, in Karachi. My father took me. At that time, Sindh was the province of the British Empire, and Sindh was playing Bombay or something like that. Bombay was Bombay Presidency. It was, people just came, they saw the match, they bought a ticket, saw the match and went off. Today you see on TV, the match is played for TV, not for the audience sitting in the ground. You know that very well. So the money comes from advertisement, and in order to pep up the advertising revenue, all sorts of things are done. People are encouraged to fight on the field because that is exciting for the people. So there is a moral degeneration that has come. And the first, going back to the golden age, the first thing is to say, I will not be a part of the moral degeneration. I'm going to walk out. It may cost me something. I'm going to lead my life, would be it as a doctor or a teacher. But I won't fall prey to it. I'm not going to give 1 minute of my time to that. That's a very good first step towards the golden age. How many people are prepared to do that?
I am reminded of what Albert Einstein said. He said the world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it.
This man had a habit of saying wonderful things apart from doing great physics. That shows how much he thought about the world and its problems. Anyway, I have a great personal regard for Albert Einstein for his great contributions to physics and to what I call the purpose of human life. It was a solid. In fact, not many know, there was a German doctor, his name was Albert Schweitzer.
Yes.
He used to go to Africa and he had a dispensary there and he used to run it. But to run it he needed money. So we'll come to Europe. He was a good friend of Einstein. Albert Schweitzer was a good pianist and Einstein was a possible violinist. They would both give concerts. And because of the star names, the place will be packed, house full. Tickets are highly priced. And Schweitzer will take all the money and go to Africa. So, he will come to Germany to, you know, give concerts along with Einstein.
Oh, wow.
Of course, Einstein didn't need the money, and neither did Schweitzer, except for living. He will take that back to his clinic in Africa.
Oh, wow.
Amazing story.
In fact, sometime back I read a very beautiful quotation of Albert Schweitzer. I didn't know all this story about him. I know that he's a Nobel Prize winner, isn't it, sir?
Actually, he got the Nobel Prize for something for which he had to wait quite some years. And if I'm not mistaken, he was in Japan when the announcement was made. And he could not go to Stockholm. They have ceremony in December. That's when the King of Sweden formally decorates the person with the medal and gives the certificate and all that. He missed it, but they had a ceremony for him later. He did many things for which he could be given the Nobel Prize, but they selected one out of the many and he got that Nobel Prize for that. He made very phenomenal contributions last century. We are now in the 21st century. And they were truly heartbreaking.
I remember him for one very beautiful quotation, which is attributed to him. He once said, "I don't know what your destiny will be, but one thing I know. The only ones among you who will be really happy are those who have sought and found how to serve."
Yes, he hit the nail on the head. By the way, Einstein admired Gandhi very much. And when Gandhi died, he said, "In years to come, people will scarce believe that such a man actually walked on earth." That's what he said, to the extent I remember. See, Einstein had seen problems. In the sense, Einstein was there in Germany during the First World War. In fact, there was conscription during the First World War. At that time, Germany had an emperor. That emperor was Kaiser Wilhelm or somebody. And he refused to enlist in the army. He said, "I am a conscientious objector. I don't believe in war." So they allowed him. There was a provision in law that allowed conscientious objector. Similarly, in England, Sir Arthur Eddington refused to join the army. But he said, "I will work as an ambulance corps volunteer," like Gandhi did in South Africa. So they were actually in opposing countries. One man was in England, other man was in Germany. And during the war, Eddington was actually preparing a lot to test one of Einstein's predictions based on relativity. Imagine that. He didn't say he's my damn enemy or something. Because Einstein had predicted that gravity can bend light. And this Eddington had conceived a way of testing it. And he was preparing for that for 3 years because he wanted a good total solar eclipse that occurred 3 years later. And he prepared 2 crews, one to go to South America, one to go to Africa and all that. It's just very strange. They are on opposite sides. And this man had made a prediction, that man was trying to verify it. But that's not the point I'm trying to make. After Germany was defeated in First World War, it was treated very shabbily. And it had to pay back damages via reparations. The government that came into power It was a good government, but they could not bear the loan burden. So Germany went into a tailspin. And so bad it was that to buy a loaf of bread, you had to take a wheelbarrow of currency, marks. The mark became worthless. That was when Hitler rose to power. And Hitler made no secret of his hatred for Jews, absolute hatred for Jews. Hitler had seen that. And he, with great regret, decided to leave Germany, I think in 1930 or so. Don't remember. And he went to America, settled there. And he had seen evil coming and rising high. Of course, he saw the defeat of Germany. And then he also saw the development of the atom bomb, for which in a way he was indirectly responsible. Because the scientists who had gathered in America, mostly from Europe, they knew about the possibility of the atom bomb. And they wanted the American government to get focused on it. They wanted him to write to the president of the US, because Einstein had an aura, stature. He was a rock star. So if he says to the president, maybe the president will pay some attention. So they told Einstein, you do write the letter. And he had a friend called Szilard from Hungary, who had already decided that it is possible to build up an atom bomb. And he had sort of worked it out crudely. Of course, details are not known to anybody at that time. They had to discover new physics, new laws, and so many things. But Einstein wrote a letter to Roosevelt. There is a possibility of developing a super bomb. But nobody realized it could wipe out a whole city. And when that happened, he was horrified. And in America, he dared to say, nuclear weapon is an evil, we must abolish it. And he said that in the late 40s, early 50s. At that time, there was a man called Senator McCarthy in the Senate. He was a rabid hater of the Russians, communism, and so on. If you say anything that did not agree with the policy of America, he will call you are an anti-American. So many film stars, actors, professors were all affected. They lost their jobs, they were hounded. Many went away from America to other countries. We won't live in a place like this. But they dare not touch Einstein, because he had a super reputation. But he was bold enough to antagonize anybody. He said, this is evil. Didn't you see the evil in those places? Do you want to rule with an evil weapon in your hand? He, Bertrand Russell, all started global campaign to ban the atomic weapons. So he dared to speak the truth to power. The man who wrote to the president, you must consider building a bomb, said, yes, the bomb has been built, it's pure evil, get rid of it.
And I think since then, the pile of nuclear arms went up, and perhaps now, in the recent past, there is some decision to bring it down. I don't know how much of it has really happened, but someone said, I don't know, again, if it is Einstein, said, if there is a fourth world war, then, you know, we'll be fighting only with...
Not fourth, third.
No, they say, if there is a fourth, we'll be fighting only with stones and spears, because the world would have just gone back to Stone Age.
I can tell you, in Stone Age, there could not have been a world war, because world is so big and people are there everywhere. I can't imagine a man coming from South America to Bangalore and fighting with us or something like that. No, it is true. They said the world will be wiped out in a third world war fought with nuclear weapons. That's a long story, but it was said so. But people were so seized by fear. And, you know, as late as 1980, America had 30,000 nuclear weapons. Well, Russia had 33,000 nuclear weapons. 33,000, 30,000. That makes it almost 65,000. And these weapons, atom bomb was a toy. were hydrogen bombs. The smallest hydrogen bomb was about 10 times as more powerful as Hiroshima bomb. And the largest hydrogen bomb was something like 500 times. The Russians had a bigger version, 1,000 times.
Oh my God.
1,000 Hiroshimas in one bomb. Can you believe that?
Do we really need this in our times?
We need it as badly as we need a hole in our head, as the Americans would say. But the world was so paralyzed with fear, they remained in that frozen state. And it was what is called a mad doctrine, mutually assured destruction. So it was frozen, everything was frozen. Till some sense came into Ronald Reagan, and Gorbachev was broke. He was sort of heading the USSR. And he said, we will sign an arms reduction treaty. And they brought it down to 3,000 each, 30,000, factor of 10. There it is stuck. They have not moved further. The driver moves to bring it down further, but nothing has happened.
If only this much of human intelligence, human capital, human manpower and time is spent on trying to solve the problems of the world through the heart and not trying to increase the fear quotient in the world, but try to increase the love quotient in the world, I think the world would have been definitely a different place.
Absolutely, but there are two points which are not covered by your remark. A man named David Bohm, who by the way was one of the fellows, he was actually a student of Robert Oppenheimer, who was the head of the atom bomb project from the scientific side. He was a student. He ran away from America at the end of World War. Found it too hot. He went to England. He settled there and died there. He was a great philosopher and a good physicist too. And he had read the Upanishads and all that. In a book called Some Thought is the Mind, I don't remember the title, he says, the mind is good at creating problems. And then it tries to solve them. It can never solve the problems it creates. Because in the process it will create more problems. So, atom bomb, everything, market forces, everything, these are all products of the mind. Mind is extraordinarily powerful because it is the child of the Atma, as Swami said. And in the Gita, in chapter 10, Krishna says, among the senses, I am the mind. The power of God is in the mind. Now, I will go back to Einstein, whom you quoted. He says, no problem can be solved at the level of consciousness at which it is created. In other words, if the mind creates a problem, the mind cannot solve it. He leaves it there. That is exactly what Bohm said. So you must go to the higher level, dimension. The higher dimension is the level of the heart. We are prevented from going to the level of the heart by desires. The desires are a big chain. That's why Krishna says, desire is their greatest enemy, O Partha. Of course, we can't get rid of all desires.
Because that is at the root of selfishness and self-interest.
Absolutely. But then, Krishna also says something. Everybody cannot be a Gandhi, but try to be at least a sattvic man, so that your desires are under control and people can live with each other in the Ubuntu spirit. They are not Gandhis, but they understood the essence of living in harmony with each other. So that is a huge step as far as the practical world is concerned. If you want to go beyond that, then you have to be a yogi or go on the Bhakti Yoga mark and Karma Yoga mark and all that. But come up to that stage, you will at least be a less of a problem to yourself and to others.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really reminded of what William Wordsworth once said, and I love this quote, where he says that the best portion of a good man's life is his little nameless and unremembered acts of love and kindness. I think if all of us can do these acts, which are nameless, little acts of kindness, as they say, random acts of kindness, for which we expect nothing. They say that day is perfect when you have helped, done something for someone who can never do anything in return for you. I think if every person sort of moves on this path, then slowly that golden age will definitely come.
That is really true. Countless people have said this. Countless people have said it. This is ordinary people leading ordinary lives. The point is, they intuitively understood the essential road to leading a peaceful, harmonious, good life. That they understood. So, we have no time to think about, I don't know how many people know the name Wordsworth. In fact, I wonder how many people would know the name Einstein, because he died in 1954 or 55, I don't remember. Who is Einstein, they will say. The people live in the now and present and nothing else matters. They live in a world where things go viral, 2 days later there's a new viral fever and so on it goes. So we have got into a trap, as Einstein has said somewhere. We are living in a world which is a trap built by ourselves. We have imprisoned ourselves. So get out of that prison and go at least to the level of sattva. Then if a lot of people live at that level, you will not get pure gold, but you will get an alloy of gold and maybe copper, that's all. Which is not too bad. It is not too bad.
I remember when Swami mentioning on one occasion that there is what we need today is not a new religion or a new philosophy or a new culture. What we really need is only a pure heart. That's all is what is needed.
How can you add to that? It's not a... So, we started with the golden age, and let me end with the golden age, because the clock is ticking. The golden age is a goal. And when Swami declared the golden age will come, he didn't give the fine print. The golden age is sure to come if all of you make efforts to become personally Bangarus. So we have to find out what Swami meant by Bangaru and how do you get that title from him. That title can be given and taken away any time. So you must make sure he gives the title and you validate it from day to day, minute to minute, second to second. You must, once you get the title Bangaru, you must make sure you adhere to it all the time. So, once you do that, automatically your life will become golden as far as you are concerned, because you will never see evil. You will only see people who do bad things. Good man, but he has gone to the bad ways. Can I help him in any way? So you have to make your own effort. Don't try to help like a doctor. You are just an MBBS student. Don't straight away start trying to treating cancer patients. Treat people who have ordinary cough, cold and things like that. And then gradually specialize and gradually take more and more complicated cases. That's the process of growing. Rome was not built in a day. So, if all of us say, let me stop talking about golden age, let me try to become Bangaru, the golden age won't be very far off. But golden age applies to the whole of society. I can't say society you transform, I'll sit in the stands and whistle and cheer and throw my hat into the air as we do in cricket matches and all that, do all those things. You cannot be a spectator. A spectator will never see the golden age. That's my view.
Yes, I mean we have to, of course, get going. And I remember that famous thing that Mother Teresa said, that, you know, many times people say that I alone, if I do something, the world is not going to change. But yes, whatever we do, we may not change the world, but we'll be able to make a difference, a little difference. We'll be able to cast one stone which will create ripples and which will have positive cascading effect. And when many people do that, as you mentioned, little droplets, when they come together, then we'll have this beautiful world that we all are looking forward to. Thank you very much, sir, for giving your time, and looking forward to the next week when we'll take up something else interesting and continue this discussion. Thank you very much.
I just want to say, I hope to be out of the hospital soon, and I have not forgotten the Dharma series. It's left dangling in the air. I am happy there are at least a few people who are hungering for it. I assure you, I will bring it to a proper close, and I am almost near the end, and I will also be doing other things. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Sairam, dear listener, you were listening to an extempore interaction with Professor Jeevankatraman, wherein through a conversation with radio-sized Bishu, he shared his thoughts about the golden age and how and when we can see this happening around us. This was recorded at the Sri Sathya Sai General Hospital, Puttaparthi, on May 16, 2015. Dear listener, your feedback is valuable to us. You may write to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you and Sairam.